Before we get to today's show, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Veracross. With a single record database and the strongest API in the industry, Veracross is the leading SIS provider for private and independent schools, and it's now available in Australia. Support us by supporting them, so visit veracross.com/edleaders to learn more. Now let's get to today's show. All right, welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education. And we believe with better leaders, we'll make better schools. I'm your host, Luke Keller, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Matthew, before we get started, you know what I'm about to ask. Where should people sign up for the weekly email sent out by the team at Ed Leaders, and what should someone expect in the newsletter?
Well, everyone needs to head to our website, edleaders.com.au. And we really encourage people to sign up to the newsletter. We talk about leveling up your leadership game, and what you can find are some practical tips, things that you can implement, practice straight away in your leadership roles. And one thing that I've recently had a look at is some of the practical tips about how to run an effective meeting, things that you can implement straight away. So make sure you get onto the newsletter, sign up, and you'll find it really helpful. How's that, Luke?
I give that an 8 out of 10. Well done, Matt.
Well, I'm getting bigger numbers. That's good.
You're improving each week. You're listening to the feedback the audience is telling you. Now, on to today's guest, Yong Zhao. Yong Zhao is a Foundation Distinguished Professor in the School of Education at the University of Kansas and a Professor in Education Leadership at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. His work focuses on the implications of globalization and technology in education. He's published over 100 articles, 30 books. He's been recognized as one of the most influential education scholars. Amongst his work includes world-class learners, educating creative and entrepreneurial students. And in 2019, I think he foresaw the future with a book called An Education Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste: How Radical Changes Can Spark Student Excitement and Success. And I have no doubt that most of the audience knows who you are. So I'm excited. Matt's excited. Visibly excited. Look at him. He's very excited. There we go. So without further ado, let's get to it. Yong, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Luke. It's amazing to see how energetic you are on the very, very early morning.
Someone's got to bring the excitement, and it's never going to be Matt, that's for sure. We love to start the show with a bit about your journey, and I guess in your case, your journey from rural China to professor and influential education provocateur.
Well, that's let's just think about that. Yeah, you know, I came out of I was always called an extraordinarily ordinary village. Now, nobody knows what the name is, you know. It's not near any big mountain or famous river. It's just, you know, just ordinary. And had electricity and roads, you can drive a car on it now a few years ago. It's very, you know, tiny place. And now I'm, I've been a professor. So that is a interesting transformation in my life, I would say. So it's a long way, but took, I mean, I don't know, got, you know, centuries to get here. So that's a long way to get here.
And was there any particular, I guess, changes in directions or road signs that you, you know, sometimes I think, you know, when you look back, the pebbles that you leave along the way make sense. But at the time, you're just kind of going with the direction that it's given to you. Is there any particular moments along that journey where you now look back and go, wow, if I'd taken a different direction then I wouldn't be where I am today?
Well, this is actually the funny thing. That is, first of all, I just wrote a little kind of biographical notes about myself. I always talk about the idea of chance. That if you think you're in a tiny village, when there's no other hope and you are the worst kid in the village doing farm work, and where is life? I mean, nowhere, really. There's nowhere to go, actually. It's just, and suddenly, you know, Chairman Mao, you know, Mao Zedong of the country said, well, let's build some schools in a rural area. So they, you know, even that's around the Cultural Revolution when all educational systems were supposed to be destroyed, but Mao was interested in building schools in rural areas, in action in the villages. So a school was built, well, literally, they just found a room to house the kid. And they found a farm woman who probably read a little bit more than us and was trying to recruit, you know, students. And that's where my chance came. I don't think my chance came. And was also, my chance also has a lot to do with I was really bad at farming. You got really have to be bad. So my father said, yeah, since you're bad at farming, why don't you just go to school so you don't get ruined my farmland? Now, that is a very important thing. I think everyone should understand when you are bad at something, when suddenly there's an opportunity, you could probably do a slightly better. That's a chance. That's very important.
I like to joke with my brother that these hands are not made for hard work. They're made for typing.
That's probably true.
And Yong, you sort of tell us about your journey then into education, in higher education and research. Was there a moment in time where something was switched on for you?
You know, I think, you know, in education, we got a lot of ideas wrong. We always think we are educating kids, we are helping them. We forget that a lot of individual students, they are truly purposeful, intentional people. So, and a lot of times, they don't really have choices. You know, for me, you know, I went to school, and again, lucky had it, you know, when I went to school in 1970, 72, there was no hope anywhere you could go beyond elementary school. But then when I was going to graduate from elementary school, a middle school opened. When I opened a middle school, boy, the high school opened. And we went to high school and they could pass the exam, go to college now. So those were all outside opportunities open up for us. And then when I went to school, again, you know, I chose to major in English education. It was not because I loved English, because I started English in high school for 2 years. But the reason I choose to do English because I was bad at math. You know, how you know, so you gotta be bad at something. So I was really bad at math. And if you choose to major in a foreign language, your math scores did not count. That was 1982. So I said, okay. So I got, you know, I got 36 points out of my English, 36 out of 100. That's no good. And well, my math was even worse. I got 3 out of 100. So if you know math, that's really bad. So I got, you know, I began to go to English. So I majored in English, but then because my English was so bad, I got to go do something else. I was not good at, you know, Shakespeare, you know, reading all Jack London, all this stuff. I happened to find a bunch of, I think, pirated copies, you know, of magazines in education, language, linguistics. So I got into those because nobody else was good. It was even interested in that. I happened to be interested in that. So I become the best, you know. Remember, you become the best in your own domain, right? You are the only one. You are also the worst. So that is really a lot of things I would say, you know, I happen to dive into areas that people in the mainstream had no interest. So I think that is really a very interesting journey. People now call me, oh, you're a provocateur, you're an innovator. I said, no, I was just simply got into things that interested me and nobody else cared at the moment. So I just want to encourage all of us to teach students, especially those so-called poor students, to seek a way to find their value in some domain. You know, everybody has to live. You know, for me, you got to find a reason to live. And so I found my reason outside so I don't have to compete to be the worst at others.
And I'm kind of interested there in, you know, like you've talked about that journey in finding things that interested you. Over the last, you know, 10 years, I mean, can you describe the things that you do now over a week? And what does that week actually look like for you now? And maybe what it looked like, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago and how that's different now?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, 10 years ago, I was really into the technicality of teaching and education. I was just moving away from that. And now I do a lot more thinking about the broader environments, the opportunities we give to students. I would say 10 years ago, I probably spent a lot more time thinking, how do you teach this child? Now I'm actually a lot more interested in how to help this child learn, you know. But of course, every week, I you know, 10 years ago, I probably had, I had secretaries, you know, who did my book and of my presentation time, my flights, my hotel. And now I do all of those myself. Actually, it's much easier to do that. And also, you know, I think, 10 years ago, I was probably, again, not thinking much about the changing global climate, you know, both, you know, the natural climate and the geopolitical environments. You know, 10 years ago, I'm sure if you think about it, you know, that every country was seemed to be becoming good friends. Remember that time, you know, now everybody seems trying to be enemies of each other. You know, 10 years ago, there was not much conversation about investing more in weapons so we can kill each other more. And there was a lot more about, you know, more of humanity together. Now I have to worry about, you know, all this, you know, COVID, you know, the Russia war in Ukraine, and the fight between Australians cannot sell your lobsters to China or your coal, you know, that has become problematic, you know, all those kind of problems. Now, I think this is a much worse time psychologically speaking.
So you sort of talked about that sort of, you know, transformation in terms of your sort of thinking, you know, around how students learn. So what are some of the things that you're sort of doing to sort of continue to shape that, but also to get on the sort of, I guess, the conference circuit and be that provocateur?
The first message, I think, educators or school teachers, school leaders, policymakers, I think we need to really accept that human beings are purposeful, intentional, individualistic, and unique learners. And if allowed, they can learn. I know it's hard for teachers to accept the fact that, you know, unless we teach you, you cannot learn. You know, it's hard to destroy that, but it is very important. So I do a lot of writing, a lot of presentation, trying to convince, because that's the first important step. The second thing, you know, I've been trying to think a lot about is how do we help students to become good learners? You know, like in our education, we talk a lot about lifelong learner, you know, all those kind of things. But in our education, we seldom teach people how to learn. We teach them something like how to do math, how to do reading, but we don't really teach them how to learn. You know, like this is actually quite funny. In schools, we said, oh, let's get students in, talk about education. So we pick a few good school captains, talk about education. But what do they know about education? They don't do research. They don't study. I said, why doesn't every school organize a school learning improvement committee? You get students to watch YouTube, to read books, to talk to education experts, so they become experts of knowing what good education can be. I've not seen any K-12 school have a course to say, what's the learning methods? How do we learn better? You know, there are different ways to learn. Even like now, we have so much resource. We got YouTube, we got TikTok before you ban it. Okay. But TikTok, we got the ChatGPT, so many different tools. But who is teaching children what's good, what's bad? How do you tell no? We don't know. We just throw them onto it. In the social media, we complain about social media. I said, you can't really complain about any technology. Businesses are going to make money. You know, innovators are going to innovate. And the only way to deal with is to learn how to deal with them. But, you know, in our schools, we're teaching the stupid math, stupid reading. And then by the same time, why don't we help students to learn on their own? That's another thing, you know, I try to do, you know. So there's a lot of things I try to do. But I have to tell you, Matt, and look, this is a very long journey. Trying to really put students at the center of learning is extremely difficult because there are so many other players who are in the center of the system. You got the curriculum makers, the test makers, you know, policy makers, your managers. Oh, God, you got too many people and parents who occupy the space. And students have very little place for them to be who they can be.
And as you think, Yong, about, you know, those, you know, almost like those in, that interference by all the people that sort of occupy the space, what are some of the other barriers that you think that is getting in the way of teachers doing great work?
Well, I think teachers are genuinely very good, hardworking people. And I think the problem is that, you know, there are many things. They're there. So you can't really blame somebody. You know, whenever I talk about this, people always defend, oh, we are good. You know, I was talking to a group of principal association leaders. Oh, we work hard. I said, no, I don't mean you're bad. We're all good. So let's accept that everybody in education is good. Is maybe just one person is not as good, but you know, that's, we don't know who that person is. But you know, if you think about things, that's abstracting us. Curriculum, you know, you got the Western Australian curriculum, you know, you got every state has a curriculum, the government has Australian curriculum assessment, your NAPLAN, for example. You know, actually, let's take NAPLAN. I'm just writing this thing. It is really embarrassing for any developed country like US and Australia, for example. Today, in the 21st century, 20 years into it, we are still measuring reading and math. And the whole entire school system is so focused on doing that. And then we fake it. We make those scores as if they mean something. In Australia, over the last 10 years, your NAPLAN scores have not changed. But why do you measure something? It doesn't change. And also, is there any good evidence to say NAPLAN scores in third grade predicted the person's future in the long run? I mean, without family background inference, without other things. So what do you do? Why do you have those? Because we believe that. Why do you use reading and math on NAPLAN, for example, to say, oh, we have an achievement gap. Those students don't do well and this do well. Therefore, that gap must be closed. But what's the basic evidence? You simply find poor children don't do as well as rich children. But is that a real big problem? Maybe there are other ways to solve the problem since you haven't solved the problem for a long time. So I think that's another, and of course, school organization is a problem. We always organize around adults. One adult must be responsible for 20, 25, 30 children. We have to have that. And if we legally, if you don't have that, your school cannot operate, right? Where's peer learning? Where do children learn at other places? And there's other things, you know, for example, homework. Is homework reasonable? But if you don't give homework, parents get angry with you, you know, or others with you. You're not responsible. And there's so many things that I think schools can think about undo. So when I work with schools, I said, let's not think about what you want to do more. Let's say what you want to do less. And let's just do one by one. For example, let's take away that curriculum. What would happen? Let's take away the organization based on age, based on one adult. What would happen? I think schools can do that imagination exercise to try it out. So what if, you know, as a teacher, what if I didn't lecture on this? What would happen? So I think you just play with those ideas would be good imagination. I think schools always say, let's do more of this. I'm not sure doing more is the solution, you know, to start with.
One of the things that you talked about there was, you know, obviously results of testing. A question I've got for you, and obviously you've probably done a lot more research into these areas than someone like myself, but I'm interested in whether, you know, if say, for example, test scores in NAPLAN started going up in year 3, 5, 7, and all of a sudden each year we're getting 5% better results, as an example, I guess I'm wondering what, if any, impact does that have in the long run of potentially, let's say, students being smarter earlier? Like, you know, in the long run of their life, if a student is getting a 10% better result by the time they're in year 3 and they're getting a 15% better result by the time they're in year 7, what, if any, impact does that have when they're 25?
I don't know. First of all, I don't think necessarily you can improve by 5%, but let's imagine if you could. And does that improvement really mean anything to you? Like, you know, I've written quite a lot about, like, for example, you know, there are many countries, many education systems force children to do better in testing their early age. And so if I only narrow your focus on reading and math, not on, you know, that's literacy and numeracy, and you spend all your time, no sports, no playtime, nothing else, you just do improving that, you could improve, probably, but you'll become probably disabled completely, right? You know, you don't do anything else. You just try. Well, there are many countries that East Asian countries do that. You know, parents force the children to study just the subjects that's been tested. Teachers do that. School set up for that. But then when you graduate from school, you're 18. Yeah, I know. Of course, if you're lucky, you pass the exam, you go to college. If you are not lucky, what else can you do? You basically do nothing. You've wasted that time. But you don't know anything else. You know, the society, civics, participating, global movement, climate change. You know nothing about those things. And so I'm not sure it's a good thing. You know, you're not necessarily, by the way, you know, I don't know if NAPLAN scores means you're smart. You know, we know IQ test doesn't really truly reflect that, you know. And by the way, I've always found it's interesting. Those who get good IQ scores always say, I'm smart. I'm the smartest man, you know. But no one, you know, I don't know what my IQ score is. But people below 100 don't say, I'm smart, you know that. They don't tell you my IQ scores. Have you run into people just tell you, my IQ score is this? Well, you're running into not so smart people, I guess, you know. That would be say, oh, well, my God, you know. So anyway.
They're very happy to tell you about their ATAR ranking, though, Yong.
where
I ranked below, out of 10,000 students for
if they're, you know, below 75, they probably won't tell you, right?
Right. And they'll only remember for the 3-6 months after they finish year 12. Yong, you just talked about this focus on improvement, you know, and I think what you're really questioning is, well, is that the purpose? You know, and one of the things that, you know, you've spoken about is the fact that, you know, every government comes into power and thinking they're the messiah for education and that they're going to be the great reformers and we're going to improve sort of the status quo, if you like. Talk to me about why education sort of and governments fail to truly reform the education sector.
Well, let's first establish that, at least from my look at over the last 30 years, that's what I've seen. Okay, I don't want to say 50, but, you know, data would say 50, 100. Schools really have not changed much on the large scale. But of course, this is not to say schools don't change. We do see a few schools innovate a lot. Okay, so, but you know, every day you run into some. Oh, we are doing big reforms. We're changing our school, but true changes, massive change schools. I haven't seen many. Okay, so governments have been trying to change schools, improve education. Like you said, everybody wants to be the messiah to say I can do it. I think they cannot. You know, the big problem first of all is education cannot be improved. Any improve, it doesn't make sense. You know, begin like we've been improving curriculum, assessment, pedagogy, teachers, accountability. We've tried everything, except we never try to give students more time to run their own learning. We've never put that, said, let's get students to be the managers of learning. Let's students to be the builders. I think, you know, governments, you can play. Imagine how hard it is to create a new curriculum. Once you create the new curriculum, you have to make sure schools teach to that. You have to spend money building the, you know, the professional development on that. Just imagine the Acara, you know, just have done all these things. I mean, really, how many teachers, how many schools, and do they truly teach to that? And do you have, you know, curriculum police to do it? And if we did not like that, you know, there was other states, I think Australia said, oh, we want to start with improving our teachers. We want to recruit the best high school graduates into our teacher education, and we'll retain them, we'll retrain them. You know how long that takes? God, that's probably 10, 20 years. By the time you finish it, you the whole situation has changed. And I think right now, you look at, actually, ChatGPT is a wonderful technology. You have governments that let's ban it. You have governments that no, let's not ban it. Governments changing their mind. No, we cannot actually ban it. We got to do something. But do you imagine the policymakers see that? They don't. If they don't see that, what will happen? Actually, I was just reading the news in the U.S. today. It says a few days ago in Nebraska, there was a high school, a student passed the speech, in end of the, on graduation, a student can go compete for a speech spot. And his speech was written with ChatGPT. So he was selected. But once he selected, he did not even read his ChatGPT written. He said, I hate school. So the school was very surprised. But anyway, it's a very interesting story to go on. But the whole idea is that when you try to improve a tiny little bit, the impact on individual student is not much. So why don't we, that's why, I've always advocated for schools. Why don't you build school within the school to do a complete change for a small percentage of students who are not benefiting much from the traditional system?
So with that in mind, if you were to land in Australia and all of a sudden the Prime Minister came up and said, we're going to bypass the election and we're going to install you as the Federal Minister for Education, Yong, what would be the first few things that you would try and deliver?
Well, if I had that honor, I don't think I can. I would be fired and driven away in 3 days. But imagine, if I had 3 days, or maybe a day.
I reckon you could achieve a lot in 3 days.
I know.
I reckon you could.
So I think that there are several things I would like to do. First of all, I would really like to create what I call innovation zones. That is, allow schools to apply to say, we will not do whatever the government forced us to do, the curriculum, the testing, for 5 years. I mean, just because, you're using tax dollars. Taxpayers still want to hold you accountable. And we will have a new way to hold ourselves accountable. We'll get a lot more autonomy. Let's see what schools would apply to do that. And second thing I probably want to do is to allow students to apply to organize their own schools. And if they can find the right, you can have the right infrastructure. Not online learning is possible. So if a student, let's say a high school, probably let's say year 10 students, you got 10 students from, five students from year 10 in Perth, another five in Melbourne, another five maybe in Adelaide, and they can organize and they go find their own teachers. And I will give you the money to do that, to try those things. And they will use, also I can say, okay, you might have teachers to say, and parents to say, we would like to organize an Australian online school. We'll take students from anywhere. So they can, teachers and you too could go, instead of running this, this podcast without making any money, but you could go run your own school to say how many students would like to pay to change that. Instead of localize and lock students into one area, we are in the 21st century. I think those things would make a lot more sense. I would not touch the entire system for everyone, but I would create new innovations, and the new innovations would bring other people in. But you have to be flexible. Like, for example, with money, how are we giving students money to schools? The students take the money from government, you go to one school, the money goes there. But why don't you free that a little bit in many different ways? I think that's about 3 days, Each day I'll do one thing, then I'll be leaving Canberra.
Yeah, you might be shipped off pretty quick. So, Yong, as we sort of talk about, those 3 days as federal minister and sort of changing the system and providing opportunities for innovation in that kind of school within a school concept, what do you think leaders would need to be able to go on that journey? What do they have to unlearn, I guess, to embrace that new way of doing things?
Well, it's extremely hard to be a school leader. Okay, I have huge sympathy for all school leaders, because every day they're busy, they're dealing with so many things. But to build a school within a school, I think school leaders really need a strong courage. Another thing is to an honest understanding. Let's say like in your school, if you're not serving the bottom 25%, apparently if they're bottom, they're not benefiting, why don't you create a new space for them? You're not doing any harm, right? Like I said, if it's already bad, why don't you create something for them? If a student keeps, you know, they don't come to school, they're tardy, they don't come, they want, why don't you create something different? You know, or you can ask students to say, you know, what would you really like to do? So because we have the responsibility to educate them, but if they're not engaged, how are you educating them? So I think an honest understanding of students and tremendous sympathy with students as individual human beings, not just a student. You know, I think we have this automatic assumption that education is good. Yes, education is good, but what kind of education is good? We have to understand. If you ask people, how many of you have been hurt by school? How many of you have wasted your time in school? I think we just need to be very honest. I think school leaders can do this because the pressure is actually, or the risk is very small because you're not doing anything. Because you're not affecting the majority, you're not affecting the tradition, you're not affecting your heritage, you are creating an essential space for those students who are willing, those parents who are willing, those teachers who are willing to create something new.
And in talking about that, are there specific examples that you've seen, you know, either in Australia? You know, there's a couple of, you know, that are really well known, but, you know, in other parts of the world that are doing what you've just described with, you know, being courageous, but also creating, you know, these areas for, you know, students who may be more disengaged with the traditional style of education. Are there schools that you kind of look at and go, wow, they're doing some really interesting things?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, both of you know the All Saints College in Perth has done that. They built a school in Fremantle Market. I think that's, you know, a studio school. That's amazing if you go take a look. Another school that's trying this is the Scots College in Sydney. That's been trying some of these things. And I've been working with a school in China, in Chongqing, China. Number 8 school, they are trying to do this, similar things. And you know, there are U.S. schools have been trying to do this. But, you know, I think I've been working with quite a bunch of schools. And there are a bunch of schools in Adelaide. They're trying to do some of the things. But I think important thing is that, is you know, when you change that, it's just not buying a new program. You're really recreating a new learning experience. I think schools... you know, when I was criticizing the testing, the curriculum, I was really criticizing homogeneity. I was really criticizing uniformity, that, you know, every school has to offer education in the same way, at the same time, in the same format for every student. And, you know, but we need really diversity. We have diverse society, we have diverse people and future jobs. Extremely diverse. You know, I think a lot of times we are predicting the future based on the past, which is the best we can do, but we always forget human beings are creative. You don't know what they create in the future, you know, but we always try to control that. I think that is the problem. Not their problem, a problem, you know.
If you love what we do here at Ed Leaders, then please support us by supporting our sponsors. And today's episode sponsor is Veracross. Is your school ready for the modern age? Well, we've got good news for you. Veracross, the leading SIS provider for private and independent schools, is now available in Australia. Trusted by hundreds of schools in more than 30 countries around the world, Veracross is the only 100% cloud-based single record database built exclusively for private and independent schools. It's one system for your entire school. Integrations with popular edtech solutions like Schoolbox, Pixivity, and Digistorm enable seamless workflows and easy-to-access information. Plus, their in-country data center improves network speed and privacy so you can rest easy knowing your school's data is secure and protected with Veracross. Make 2023 the year your school moves to the cloud. To learn more about Veracross, visit veracross.com/edleaders. That's veracross.com/edleaders. And it would mean the world to us if you or your school's director of IT check them out. Now back to today's show.
And as you think about, you know, this kind of shift in sort of thinking and innovation, I can't help think that the identity and attributes of a teacher also needs to change and adapt to meet this environment. So, you know, this notion of teacher as master instructor to want a facilitator, advisor, you know, co-designer, whatever it might be. What are your thoughts about the teacher identity and the way we might shape that?
Well, I think, Matt, you got absolutely right. I mean, I've written 4 or 5 years ago, Rin, about the new context of teaching. That was, again, before ChatGPT. I think teachers really have to get off the idea that they are the content expert. They have to teach. You know, teach as English word has many, many meanings. But, you know, one thing primarily means lecturing. You know, it's you. I have to teach you. I think the concept is that today with really with tools like ChatGPT, Google's Bard, with all those tools, with search engines, with YouTube, you don't need to teach, but you do need to guide students. So I you know, one role I like is called a coach. A coach. A coach is really good. A coach understands you. A coach knows the world. A coach understands the resources. They work with you to develop your own learning plan. And a coach, I think, is very different. A coach does not necessarily have to teach you. You know, a coach says, well, you know, you're not playing the ball, right? Maybe you can want to go watch a bunch of videos, how other people play. You know, I think that is a very important change. Another thing I think teachers need to change is when you are working with individual students, not as a class, as a group. You know, traditionally, we always say, I'm teaching the group. You've got 30 students. You probably got, you know, 10 of them not listening because they know too much. It's 10 of them not listening because they don't know anything. You're teaching the middle 10 and you ignore 20. And but really, in the new model, it's if you're a coach, I work with you, you know. And of course, sometimes you work with the whole group. But really, it's individual person's growth becomes the most important.
And as you think about that too, you know, I can't help think as you're sort of describing teacher as coach, there's a fundamental shift as we consider knowledge. So knowledge imparted by the teacher versus knowledge sort of shaped and created through student experience. Does that resonate?
Yeah, you know, of course. You know, I've been thinking about it. I think COVID has made me forget all my knowledge. I know nothing now, you know. It's really, I think it is important to think about. I really don't remember a lot of things if you think that knowledge. But knowledge, let's think about this. You know, sometimes, you know, in a new teacher, let's not teach knowledge. Knowledge is not harmful, but if only knowledge, it doesn't get you very far. So knowledge, you remember something, then you lose that. So that's, you know, it's kind of, I don't know how much you remember now, Luke and Matt, you know, you go to a bar, you have this trivia contest, you may not win much, but the idea, however, there's certain knowledge that you go through that it constructs a journey for you. So, but you don't really try to teach that, you know, but what you create a personal curriculum, a personal risk course, you go through that and that will help you develop wisdom. But that, however, what knowledge is very important to think about. I think it's another thing. Human beings, I shouldn't say it, but human beings generally are not very smart. But anyway, I have many reasons to tell you why, but I don't have time. But anyway, I think that there's one thing, for example, when you assume a position, this is what I fear a lot of dictators, of authoritarianism. When people assume, when they have a position, they suddenly believe they know everything. you know. So you know a lot of powerful people are like that. So then they began to say, I will define to you what knowledge is important for you. That's the Australian curriculum. So they began to say, okay, you should read this literature. You should know this math. That is very dangerous. Actually, I had a very interesting kind of debate in Spain. Last month I was in Spain with a reporter. She was interviewing me. So she says, so personalized learning, could mean some students would not want to read Shakespeare. I said, yeah. I said, do you know how many people don't read Shakespeare today? And also, why is Shakespeare should be required by to all people? And I said, how much do you know about Confucius? You may not. And I don't know, but at certain times you have all kinds of why. For example, let's just ask, if a person does not read Shakespeare, is that person worth living? I'm sure some dictatorship said, no, you have to know this. But really, in a democracy, there's nothing to degrade Shakespeare. He's a great guy. I visited his hometown, but it doesn't mean much. But really, do you have to? Let's just think about it that way. So that is another danger I think we have, because every one of us has our own opinions to say, I love this book. You got to read it. That's a simple suggestion. But I said, if I became the Minister of Education for 3 days, I would say, every Australian have to read this book because I love it. It's better be my book. You read it and I'll test you,
I was going to say that book would probably be written by yourself. So I think that would be all right. They've got a few to choose from. I want to go back to, a comment that you made earlier about thinking time. And you talked about the time you spend thinking about different things. I'm interested in whether you have an opinion on whether you think school leaders or people in education systems, do we spend enough time thinking, whether that's deeply about what we're doing on a week-to-week or a year-to-year basis, or any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, I've been very fortunate, really, to be allowed to have the time to think. Because as a college professor, you read, you think, you do research, you write. I want to be thankful. Otherwise, I would not have had the opportunity. I don't think many school leaders had enough time to think. They have to act. So I would love it. One thing I was dreaming, I said, I would love to organize a principal's thinking time for a week. Just Yong Zhao and hang out with this guy just for a week. We just go to maybe somewhere in Margaret River, or that's a nice place to be, or you have better place in. We get a few books, a few video. We just think and talk. Just think deeply about okay, let's reflect. Schools can be symbolically good, but really, how are you good to each student? And we say, okay, we're helping students develop this, but really, how are we doing that? I don't think we had enough time to think, but also, thinking is just not by yourself. It is a collaborative process. It is a conversational process. I think right now, we are just so constrained by our environments. Because if you go to, I've seen a lot of school principals, you go there, you got so many people wants to talk to you. You have so many things to make quick decisions. But really, I think that kind of thinking, maybe Matt, look, you can organize that. We can do it. And just for a week. Just a week. We're not going to force ideas. We're just going to be honestly reflecting on things. To say, I think that kind of thinking is very powerful and much needed.
I think we can make that happen, Yong. The Ed Leaders and Yong's our thinking tour. And I think we can run two. I think we can run one in Margaret River, and I think we can run one in the Whit Sundays.
Well, I think the important thing is this, I've seen a lot of people doing, professional development presentations. I just think many people are trying to market to you to say they have a set of ideas, a program schools should buy. But I don't think that's the best way, actually, because I really believe the creativity lies with teachers, with school principals and the students. It is your community that are creative, but that creative needs to be guided by thinking, needs to be guided by wisdom, needs to be encouraged by yourself. That's why I'm not liked by a lot of education people who try to market the products. I say, no, I don't believe that. I just think people, your people are the best you have, but they need to be given time, guidance, facilitation, and support to become the truly valuable innovators and creators you need.
Hmm. Zong, I just want to pick up that notion of creativity and, you know, this idea that, you know, through a contemplation week, a reflective week, that people can, be creative or be creators. But can we teach creativity? I know you've got a few things to say on that notion, and it's certainly a tension that exists in schools. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Well, I've actually said that. I said creativity cannot be taught, but it can be killed. So we kill creativity. But however, creativity, let's assume that most of our creativity have been suppressed. So my view is not to teach you to be more creative, but it's to liberate you. Because you are actually creative. Everybody is creative, has to be creative. So we need to, how do you become more creative? Creativity is not just, trying to throw a bunch of, wasted mashed potatoes and hope to make a submarine out of it. It's not, that's creative, but it doesn't work very well. And you have to constrain. A big thing is that creativity has to do with self-efficacy, confidence, but it also has to constrain certain things. That's why I said, a guided rethinking school in a week is really what we say, okay, we're focusing our creativity. We're liberating our creativity. We're allowing you to imagine the impossible. People always use the term, imagine the impossible, but it has to be in the domain. Right? I mean, as I said before, you can't, a bunch of wasted mashed potatoes does not help your students become better students necessarily. But you want to say, okay, there's some creativity needs to be certain knowledge based, wisdom based, context based. But also at the same time, if we're folks talking about, what if we just get rid of the state curriculum? What would the school be? What if we get rid of grades, organize my year? Now, that's meaningful creativity. But maybe some school leaders may have never thought about that. We can undo that. No, okay, then this thing, but if we really undid it, what would happen? So that there's creativity. So I think creativity definitely can be improved, but there are many creativity courses. I think they're just scams. They're just trying to teach you this skill, that skill, think this. I have to have a little confession to make. I hate any kind of gadgets that make me think. You go to meetings, you go to conferences, they have that, stand up three times, do that. They have all those kind of little ways trying to make you do things. It may work for some people. But not for me. So we have really think about also creativity is also very personal. It is a lot more experience. I can tell you this one example. I think I said every meeting I go to, people would say, okay, let's stop, listen to some music. It's great. I said, I have no touch to music. I hate music. I don't even hate it. Okay, I don't know enough to hate it. I never had access to music. On my phone, I don't even have a song. I said, when you guys were listening to music, feeling creative, I said, I don't get it. What are you creative about? So it's also extremely personal, So anyway, we can go on and talk about that for a long time.
when it comes to collecting your thinking, whether that's after going through, having time, or whether it's through a creative process, or is there any tools that you or frameworks that you use that to collect that thinking and to distill it into, more meaningful kind of observations or next steps forward?
Well, there are a lot of kind of little things I have created, but really the thing that I would say depends on what you do with it. For example, if you're running a school, I always say three things that are important. If you, is the learning personalized? Basically, do you know what your students want to learn and what do they want to do with that? You know, so I've always talked about students, strength-based, passion-driven. Number two, does your teaching always start with a problem worth solving? I would always start teaching by asking students to identify a problem. You know, I teach PhDs and doctoral students, but I always, you know, I said, what problem do you want to solve? Why are you in this class? I know you need the grades, but if I give you all A's, would you quit? You know, so I would always start with some problem students find interesting. Third, I would always liberate my teaching beyond my classroom. So I said, learning needs to be global. You know, it's easier said than done. You know, like now we are doing this global. I mean, Oregon, in the US, you guys are in Perth, in Australia. But how often do students get up so early, chat with someone, learn about this? We can all learn. So that's, you know, one area. You know, if we follow that, those three things can have tremendous, you know, it can go on for a week. Like, for example, how do you know a student is interested in this? How do you know if a student is good at this? What about, you know, there's a non-strength? You know, what if I'm worried about this piece they don't get? You can go on for a whole week to be creative. And then you study, okay, what's prohibiting us from doing this? Like, you can go on for a long time. Mm.
And Yong, as we sort of, you know, think we're taking a bit of a journey through systems, we've talked a little bit about leaders and we've talked about teachers and how they might sort of shape learning. Obviously, one of the things that we are struggling in this country is teacher shortage. You know, there's a great challenge here of getting teachers into the profession. You know, what are your thoughts about how might we solve this problem as it continues to grow across different states?
You know, Matt, in the U.S., we have the same problem, you know, teacher shortage. The basic thing is that we have to think about who is a teacher, who can be a teacher. I think that, you know, they are, you know, as systems develop along the way, it's very hard to become a teacher. You know, that you have to go through this education, you have to be certified, you got to go all the way. And I remember, you know, you probably have interviewed Sugata Mitra already, right? Have you done that? When Sugata Mitra is a British, you know, I think an educator, education technology person. He's from India. So I remember he was doing this interesting project. I think he was talking this in Melbourne a few years ago. Think about Indian villages. Do they have teachers? If you have a teacher shortage problem, don't they have a much worse problem? So what he was doing the phone in, put them in a high tree. He then recruited grandparents, what he called, you know, the whole project is called Grandma in Cloud, Grannies in Cloud. So there's grandpas in London, and they would be wired in. So then the students would ask them questions. And then they become a teacher. They solve some of the teaching problem, right? Don't you think in Australia, don't you have a lot of retired people, for example, who they would love to hang out with some kids, but the government may not allow them to do that, right? And, you know, so why do you have to hire a teacher? So you have, and students, you have high level students, your year 12 students. I've seen students in Hawaii in a school called Punahou. I mean, they're good students, you know, in math, in reading, they just sit up tutoring sessions for anyone who needs them during lunch hour. You know, could they be managing the others? If you give students that responsibility, they might be even more interested. Also, if you divided mentoring and learning in a different way, you got one adult, you know, teacher supervise 100 students, but the 100 students are learning from different resources. How would that solve the problem? I just think we solve the problem in the wrong way. We say, let's produce more teachers. You don't have time. You have students in your school. How do you have time to prepare? Students don't wait. Let's wait for the government to prepare another 5,000 teachers who will go to school then. That don't happen, you know?
A lot of people would point to you, Yong, as someone that they draw inspiration from. But I'm wondering where you find your inspiration. Who do you look to?
I look at actually at you guys. I talk to a lot of school leaders and school teachers and actually students. You know, I got a lot of students emailing me, asking me about a project, all those things. I get really a lot of energy from talking to people, a lot of inspiration, because like the conversation with you is just so wonderful. And it allowed me to say something, but more important, I hear you from where you are. What you give me is very powerful. So I want to thank you, Luke and Matt.
And Yong, any final words of advice for school leaders and teachers in the trench? What might be your last sort of words of wisdom for them?
Well, I'm not sure it's wisdom, but I always tell people, I say,
oh, come on.
But I always tell them, I say, you have to be creative to be happy. You know, as a teacher, as a school leader, if you're doing something worthwhile, you are happier. You know, because otherwise you are really drained by the details, unhappy details. Try to be above that. Every day, if you can try some new ideas, you feel good. So anyway, I think being creative is very selfish. You feel better if you're creative, you know. Go home after school, make a very creative cocktail. I think that might be wonderful, you know.
Well, that brings us to my favorite segment of the show, Yong, which is 6 in 60 seconds. The ground rules are pretty simple. One word or idea for each question. And we'll see how we go. Not everyone follows the rules, so we'll see how you perform. One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the past decade.
Underrated is student-centered. Overrated is achievement gap.
What's one thing you're most proud of during your career?
Being able to talk to students, any age.
The most interesting professional development you've ever done?
I don't think I've ever done anything interesting in that regard. No.
The most interesting version of education you've seen being delivered by a school?
Well, that's the student school, by all sins.
One book worth reading apart from your own?
Oh, it's called The Dawn of Everything. This is a thick book. You should really read it, The Dawn of Everything. It's basically a rewrite human history about social equity. It's just beautiful. It's a wonderful book.
And I'm just going to slip it in there. If someone had to read one of your books, which one would you choose? It's like choosing your favorite son or daughter, but...
Well, I would say every book, but you know, I would read the What Works May Hurt. What Works May Hurt, Side Effects in Education.
All right. And the last question, one person we should interview on the podcast.
Try Ron Beghetto. Ron Beghetto, R-O-N-B-E-G-H-T, G-H-E-T-T-O.
We will have creativity to ask you research.
We work a lot together. It's definitely worth interviewing.
Excellent. Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I feel like we've really just scratched the surface to some extent in talking to you, Yong. But I really want to thank you for giving up your time. I know it's your time super valuable. So we're super excited to have you as a guest, and I'm sure our audience will love hearing what you've got to say. Matt, any closing comments? I know you've got them.
There's quite a few, but I'll try and keep them really brief. I love that notion of flipping this notion, this idea of improvement. So what might we do less of, not more of? And I think that's a great challenge. I also loved students. What if we gave students the ability to choose their teachers, to go out and find them, and to really be student-centered in our approach? And, you know, the notion of creativity, that's something that, you know, I'm really interested in. But what if we were to liberate it? You know, we're not here to teach creativity, but to liberate it, to provide the space, within domains, to foster it, to shape it, to nurture it. So for me, there's some of the key takeaways from our discussion. Luke, what have you got?
Well, probably not surprisingly, I love that notion of the innovation zones in schools, giving schools, you know, some flexibility and some freedom to kind of explore new ways of delivering education and educational experiences that may better meet the needs of certain groups or pockets of students. And I probably came back to it a couple of times, but you know, that notion of thinking time, you know, I do think that we don't spend enough time thinking, you know, deeply about things that are in the future, whether that's strategically or our vision of education or how we can do things differently or what we're doing well and what we should be doing less of. And so I think there's something for people to think about there in terms of, and I know Matt and I have talked about this previously offline, but where in your calendar have you carved out as a leader an hour a week for thinking time, you know, or more, but at least an hour a week for thinking time. And I think that's a good challenge for leaders. And I'd like to take Yong up on that offer at some point and create a little a thinking week, I think would be super interesting for Australian leaders and educators across. So Yong, thank you for giving up your time again to be on the podcast. For the audience out there, I'm sure they've already know how to find you, but if they want to connect with you, if they want to know more about the work that you're doing, where's the best place to find you and follow you on the internet?
Best is really find on my website. It's zhaolearning.com, zhaolearning.com. I post a lot of things, all my writings up there. You know, if anyone wants to contact me, you know, they can email me at yongzhaoeducation@gmail.com. I have a Twitter account, but I don't trust anymore. Elon Musk is going to ruin that anyway, so forget about that, you know.
And anything closing you'd like to add before I wrap up the show?
Well, thank you so much. I hope people listen to it. I love it. I love the question. Love connecting with you. We can do this every day if you want, and you know, just we can try this. But anyway, thank you so much, Matt and Luke.
Yeah, thank you. Now, remember, for the audience out there, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show and please don't forget to share the love and tell a few of your colleagues that you listened to this awesome episode with Yong Zhao and that they should have a listen too, and probably send it to your principal, I'd say, because I think every principal should have at least have a listen to this episode. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're not already signed up to the Ed Leaders newsletter, you are missing out. We publish a new issue every couple of weeks and it's jam-packed with information and gold. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. Thanks again for the spot today for the sponsors of our show. We'd be grateful if you spend a few minutes of your day going to their website and checking them out as they support us to make this professional learning free for you. You can connect with Ed Leaders and both Matt and I on LinkedIn, where we'll keep you up to date with all the latest. Thanks again for listening and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.